My name is Greg Felton. I have been working journalist since 1993. I have also been an English instructor since about 2003. I have a master's degree in political science, and I'm largely self-taught in matters of Middle Eastern politics and of late in epidemiology and virology. I've written three books. The first, The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America, published in third edition 2018. Exploding Middle East Myths, which is a compendium of 15 years of essays on censorship, the Middle East, movies, and satires. And most recently, last November actually, I wrote a book on the SARS-CoV-2 virus, called SARS-CoV-2 Contagion, Collusion, Corruption. It essentially demonstrates that the virus is entirely man-made, that claims of a natural origin are indefensible, both genetically and rhetorically. In fact, every attempt to build a case for natural origin has collapsed. And yet, that theory is still the standard by which most people understand the virus, which is rather disturbing. Anyway, I write freelance essays on politics, not nearly so frequently as I used to because of work-related matters and such like, and writing a book. I hope to get back into writing more frequently this month. But that's about it. I was born and raised in Vancouver. I speak Russian, French, and Chinese, among other languages, to a lesser degree.
Okay, so can you give us, in a nutshell, I know it's not an easy thing to do, what you think are the main three take homes that we should understand to get to grips with this idea of SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 being man-made?
Well, first of all, let's clear our terminology. SARS-CoV-2 is the virus. COVID-19 is the disease that the virus causes, mostly a respiratory disease affecting the lower part of the lung, as well as the kidneys, the intestines, and other major organs. The one thing to understand, I think, is that this was manufactured in a laboratory, most likely the Wuhan Biological Safety Level 4 lab in Wuhan, China. It hasn't been admitted, I think, probably because nobody wants to admit they're responsible.
But Greg, what's
But
your evidence for that? What are the main three bits of evidence that you can say, well, there's this, this, and this, and that
okay.
should really give you a conclusion that it's a man-made, maybe even actually a bioweapon?
Okay, whether it's a bioweapon is rather is kind of tangential because whether it is or not, it wouldn't affect the nature of the virus and its contagiousness. So I will say that the one thing that is proof that this is not a naturally occurring virus is something called a furin cleavage site, which is in SARS-CoV-2. Now, to make a long story even longer, as Steve Allen used to say, a furin cleavage site is a genetic sequence in which there are four amino acids. The bookends of those four are basic amino acids of either histidine, lysine, or arginine. In the case of SARS-CoV-2, there are two arginines at the end of this cleavage site. Now, furin is an enzyme produced in the body, throughout the body, in multiple organs. It's very widely distributed. And furin will see a protein that has this kind of telltale, let's say, lock, and it is the key that opens the lock, for example. It will cleave the protein at the end of the fourth amino acid in that sequence. And by doing so, it energizes and primes the protein to work. Now, because the protein, the SARS-CoV-2 protein, has this sequence, it is cut. Because the furin is much more widely distributed in the body than other enzymes like cathepsin or trypsin, its effect on the human body is magnified many times. Now, coronaviruses do not have a furin cleavage site, except for MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. And that is of a different family than SARS-CoV-2, and frankly, does not really factor into the discussion. SARS-CoV-2 belongs to the coronaviruses clade B, which is also the one that includes SARS. SARS does not have it. And there's no evolutionary mechanism by which SARS-CoV-2 could have acquired it in such a short space of time. It had to be inserted manually into the genome of SARS. Now, where it comes from is still not absolutely certain. However, there is a good case to be made that it was spliced in from HIV. And there are four Indian doctors, among others, like Birger Sørensen from Norway, who showed that there were these segments from HIV in SARS. And one of the four sequences that the Indian doctors pointed out happens to have a furin cleavage site. So it is much more plausible to argue that this HIV insert with a furin cleavage site is what has made SARS, the SARS virus, SARS-CoV-2, and has given us an infection, a highly infectious but somewhat less lethal virus. What's also interesting is that the arginines in question of this cleavage site have a certain nucleotide sequence which is very rare. Now, for those of you who have never studied biology, an amino acid is a group of three nucleotides. Now, occasionally, there's more than one combination of nucleotides, nucleotides of which there are only four. Now, one of the nucleotides that can create arginine is comprised of cytosine, guanine, and guanine. That's very rare. And there are two back-to-back in the furin cleavage site of SARS-CoV-2. Now, this is something that is sort of contrary to the notion that nature creates random mutations. And there are random mutations in amino acids. In fact, sometimes you can have a mutation on an amino acid that changes one nucleotide but does not change the amino acid. In some cases, there are about three different types of amino acids. And one of the composite compounds happens to be, in this case, CGG, which is very rare. So you have to ask yourself, how is it possible that these two very rare arginines could have come simply by nature? And frankly, it isn't really possible. Because of the furin cleavage site, one, and two, because of the rarity of the arginines in the furin cleavage site, there is very little evidence to suggest that there is a natural origin to this virus. Now, the trouble with truth statements in a culture like our culture is that there's always somebody prepared to say that's true, that's not true. What matters is how the evidence lines up. The evidence for a furin cleavage site being inserted artificially is overwhelming. There is no evidence, however, to suggest that there is any natural origin for this furin cleavage site. And for that reason, it is not possible to argue that SARS-CoV-2 is a naturally occurring virus.
The other question's got to be, hasn't it, whether or not this was released accidentally or deliberately. Would you like to speculate on that?
Sure. Before I could say that it was released deliberately, I would have to be able to conclude that there was a motive for doing it. And to be quite honest, I don't see one. People who claim this was deliberately released have, to be quite honest, no evidence for this. They simply want to believe it because they have an animus against the Chinese Communist Party, or imagine that there is some sort of world campaign to depopulate the planet or some such thing. There is no evidence to suggest it was deliberately released. And in fact, as my book shows, laboratories in Beijing and Wuhan, to say nothing of the United States, have a history of very sloppy biosafety procedures.
Can I just say, though, that you've got one massive impact of this SARS-CoV-2 has been economic. And there is actually an economic war going on between what was anyway, the Trump administration and China.
Yes, there is. As far as this goes, to the way I understand it, that the United States got upset at its trade deficit with China and wanted to do something about it. In the same way that it arbitrarily and without any logic decided to abrogate the North American Free Trade Agreement to impose upon Mexico and Canada a different arrangement. Notwithstanding the animosity between China and the United States, I still do not see any theory that could allow for a deliberate release. First of all, why would China deliberately release a contagious virus in its own country? This does not make sense. If China wanted to infect the world to undermine the Western economy, for example, it would have done what the character of David Morse did in the movie 12 Monkeys. It would have taken bacillus and viruses overseas and released them there.
But yeah, but the United States was in that lab. The Pentagon funding was funding some of the activities in that Wuhan lab.
That is correct. But then the question is, why would the United States fund something that China would then turn around and deliberately release? I mean, China had a vested interest in perpetuating funding from the United States. Now funding for SARS viruses is suspended. Nobody wins from this. Essentially, I cannot find a scenario in which there is a defensible motive for deliberate release.
About U.S. staff releasing it in China and trying to blame China for it?
I don't know what source would support that, but even still, why would the United States want to start a viral epidemic? It doesn't. Now, we can always assume that the United States is run by, well, idiots, and for whom no rational explanation of behavior will suffice. But, I mean, it's hard to imagine something so malicious and yet so counterproductive. I mean, China is, to all intents and purposes, the factory for the world. It has copious numbers of factories that manufacture all manner of merchandise, and the United States is a major market for it. Why should it want to undermine its own economy by releasing a virus deliberately in China? Now, as I say, I'm prepared to be persuaded that this is true, but so far I have seen no evidence for it. I've seen speculation, Greg, and hypotheses, but that's about all.
All right. Well, what about have you come across any more evidence then that you think backs up your theory that you've put forward in the book since you published it?
Well, I've seen nothing to contradict it. Let's put it that way. There are people who would love to believe that this was a bioweapon. And I have to concede that there is some circumstantial evidence that might tend to support that theory. For one thing, SARS-CoV-2 is an aerosolized virus, which means the width of a virus is at the micron level. So this is so light that it floats on air. Why on earth would a laboratory create an aerosolized virus unless it was planning to be used in some sort of offensive capability? Then there's also Dr. Yen Li Meng's contention that the backbone for the SARS virus comes from two coronaviruses that were developed in Chinese army laboratories. Then we have Dr. Francis Boyle, who I cite in my book, who is of the opinion that any sort of gain-of-function research represents, by definition, a violation of the Biological Weapons and Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, of which he is the author. So why on earth would you want something like this unless you plan to use it in an offensive capacity? Because frankly, the idea of having biological devices as sort of defense against biological warfare is a non-starter, because you can't use a virus defensively. It's stupid. There are a number of reasons that it does look right, but unfortunately, there's no real, say, smoking gun to prove that this was done for biowarfare purposes.
Now,
it does look conspicuous.
I wonder if you'd agree. I mean, one of the things I've seen is a tremendous amount of censorship of doctors, seeing specific doctors putting forward their points of view on YouTube being censored, and actually the mainstream press actually not letting them on in the first place seems to be the rule. And I wonder if you'd agree with that, first of all, and secondly, if there are any specific doctors that you'd like to highlight. As I mean, we have as a tendency here in the West anyway, you know, we encourage second opinions. Many people go to doctors to ask for second opinions, but it seems that certain doctors are actually being censored from giving a second opinion on SARS-CoV-2.
You're quite right, and you are thoroughly correct to say that there is active censorship going on. In fact, Dr. Joseph Mercola, who's cited in my book a few times, and when we mentioned earlier before we went on air, is his YouTube channel is under attack, because he is arguing that face mask wearing is not required to protect yourself from the virus. He argues that it's a synthetic virus. And in fact, anybody who argues that it's a synthetic virus can be censored. And we saw this in my book with Birger Sørensen, who was interviewed by Forbes magazine and said so in an interview. But then the interview edition in which he's interviewed was overlain by a subsequent edition, which ended up undermining Sorensen's case. On the one hand, he argues that there is On the one hand, he argues that there's an HIV insert in SARS-CoV-2, and yet when Forbes puts out its edition, it changes the article entirely. For example, in the original article, one of Sorensen's partners, British professor Angus Dalgleish, shows that the coronavirus's spike protein contains sequences that appear to be artificially inserted. Now, that's a statement of fact. That's a claim. That particular passage is rewritten, say that the authors of a British-Norwegian vaccine study. So Angus Dalgleish is moved into a collective noun. They claim the virus's protein contains sequences. So they've taken the certainty out and made it equivocal. They've done that frequently throughout this. And what's really nauseating about Forbes magazine is that in that magazine, where Richard Dearlove, who was head of MI6 from 1999 to 2004, he is cited as saying that the pandemic may have started in a lab. And he says that overtly. That is changed to the following sentence. I'm going to read it verbatim. However, intelligence sources from Britain's MI5 dismissed the idea as, quote, rumor and conspiracy, according to the Times of London. Well, anybody who uses the words rumor and conspiracy so glibly and so uncontextually cannot be taken at face value, because this is simply used as an intellectual disconnect. This is like a drive-by slandering. And so why would Forbes, this is interesting, why would Forbes run an article about an individual who says that the SARS virus reflects a human manipulation, only to repudiate that article and call into question Forbes' own commitment to journalistic integrity? Why would Forbes risk its reputation so overtly? I mean, that doesn't make sense. Now, the one thing you can count on, I think, whenever you end up with a scenario where you're dealing with questions in an uncertain situation. Politics, reputation, and money are the big motives for almost everything. So let's look at who owns Forbes magazine. Let's look at who the influential people are at Forbes. Let's look at the advertisers. Let's look at whose reputation could be threatened if this were to be accepted as a defensible theory. Now, if in fact, and I'm saying this in the purely hypothetical sense, SARS was manufactured, somebody, somewhere, is responsible. And nobody wants to be held responsible for a worldwide pandemic that's killed hundreds of thousands of people and infected tens of millions. So I think what we're seeing in the mainstream press is a circle the wagons bunker mentality of simply not admitting anything, simply brazening out this notion that it's a natural virus and forcing people to look at the effects of it, not the cause. Now, the one thing I respect Sorensen for is that he wanted a proper etiology of SARS-CoV-2 in order that a proper vaccine could be created. Now, right now, we're in some sort of vaccine horse race where everybody and his dog somehow is coming up with a vaccine, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and a few Moderna and a few others, Johnson & Johnson. These vaccines have not been properly vetted. It is known as a fact that SARS, if you are infected with SARS and you take a vaccine for it, you can become sicker the second time around. There is something called antibody-dependent enhancement, which means that a virus that is defeated the first time, you get over a cold or get over a virus, there is enough lingering in your body's cells somewhere that should the virus come back again, it is quite likely that you will have a far worse outbreak of it. The effect will be that much worse because the virus is already established and has built up an immunity to the antibodies. You see, what happens with these mRNA vaccines is that rather than take a bit of a dead virus and stimulate your body to create antibodies for it, which is what is done in things like the childhood vaccines of mumps, measles, rubella, polio, tetanus, diphtheria, and all that stuff. This effectively turns your body into a virus. It tricks your body into releasing the same kinds of proteins that your antibodies will attack. So essentially what you're doing is training your antibodies to attack your own body. You're creating a scenario for an autoimmune disease. So you don't want your body to generate a virus that looks like it's a foreign body, because you'll end up, this is so bizarre, you could end your antibodies could end up killing you, because your body is now the source of the virus. It's not a fighter of the virus.
So yeah, that's weird. Pretty shocking,
that,
yeah.
It is shocking, but again, so this is what happened in SARS, and there's been no evidence that any testing on ADE or antibody-dependent enhancement has been conducted on these new mRNA vaccines. It's like we're lemmings running off a cliff. Like, we don't have the intelligence to ask ourselves, is this in our own best interest? Am I going to risk my body on something that's untested just because I'm afraid I might catch SARS-CoV-2? Now, I want to mention one other thing that's in the last chapter of my book, which I hope people pay close attention to. Just because you test positive for SARS-CoV-2 does not mean you are infectious. How you tell a person has the virus is that you take a sample of their blood and you put it through what's called a polymerase chain reaction test, a PCR test, which uses a process of heating and cooling, and the addition of other nucleotides to create clones of the sample to see how many times you can reproduce the virus until it shows up on a test, because the sample of virus that's taken from a person is so small it cannot be detected. How many times you have to amplify it, the amplicon, tells you how much of the virus is in your body, what your viral load is, to use the jargon. If you have to use more than 34 generations of the virus, you have essentially nothing to contaminate anybody with. You are thoroughly non-contagious. And even Anthony Fauci, just turned 81, I believe, he admitted on YouTube, and this is, I've got this in my book, that if you have 35, if you have to have 35 cycles, then you've just got dead virus and you're healthy. The New York Times did a survey of a state-run laboratory where SARS samples were cycled 40 to 60 times to come up with a positive reading. Now, the one thing I'm rather distressed about is that these politicians who drone on about how many new cases they have never mention what the PCR test cyclic threshold is. I mean, how many of these tests represent a serious case, a possibility of infection, and how many of them are effectively duds? There's no evaluation, there's no critical thought going into how we are reacting to the virus. And it's disturbing to see the planet sort of go on autopilot, which is what is happening. I mean, I will refuse to get the vaccine because I do not have the virus, and I don't want to take a vaccine that could very easily, somewhere down the road, give it to me. So I would urge anybody with an earshot of this interview not to get the mRNA virus from AstraZeneca, Moderna, Pfizer, anything.
Vaccine.
Did I say virus? Sorry.
You said virus again, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I got a mental block about that. Anyway, so don't get the vaccine. It's just not in your own interest. And it's no guarantee that it would help you anyway.
One of the most peculiar things about this whole COVID-19, which seems to have sort of swallowed up 2020, Greg, is the way that it's carrying on and on and on. I mean, most pandemics, they will start, they'll finish within a couple of months. You get the old Gombert's curve, up it goes, down it comes, you know, people die. And then society moves on, or maybe they'll get they'll try and improve their treatment for the problem. The only thing is, this is going on and on and on. We're now being told here in the UK, oh, well, we're hoping to be able to give you Christmas 2021.
Well, that's so nice. I know this is kind of, I don't have enough information to be able to evaluate this accurately. One thing it does seem to be happening is that the virus is mutating, which is standard procedure for viruses. They do tend to change over time. And there's one mutation on the, and I've just got to figure out what page, what particular amino acid was. It was on the 614, amino acid sequence 614. There was a change from aspartic acid to glycine. And this apparently causes the virus to become far more virulent. So I don't know if that is happening or whether that is the only mutation. I know that some mink in Denmark were infected with it. And as well, there have been animals here in British Columbia that have been infected with it. So, I mean, I know it's spreading. And I know that it is still with us, but there is so much uncertainty and so much censorship of useful information that there's no possible way anybody can really get a grip of what is going on. And this is the real crime of this. This is why much of my book is geared toward the censorship of important information. Okay. About this virus.
Okay, so if it is a bioweapon or a man-made virus of some sort, and the entire world's press is suppressing this, what's the implications of that?
The implication is that nobody wants to admit it. Nobody wants to start a furor of people condemning scientists for monkeying with nature in an offensive capability. I mean, Dr. Boyle said since 1969, the United States has formally ceased all offensive germ warfare capability. Now, gain-of-function research, which is ostensibly juicing viruses to make them more virulent, more lethal to humans than nature intended, this is supposed to, you know, give scientists the ability to develop vaccines ahead of time. I mean, should this new super virus ever get out? Now, I know the irony of that is just too rich for words, because this is precisely what we have. But the whole notion of gain-of-function research as being in the public interest or in the service of public health is untenable. And there's no shortage of scientists and scientific apologists like Peter Daszak or Ralph Baric or other people who will defend gain-of-function research as being necessary, but it's not necessary. I mean, how many times are we going to have a virus that is... I mean, look at the Ebola virus. There is a good case, as Dr. Boyle pointed out, that that was manufactured by humans in a U.S. lab in Sierra Leone, when in fact the Ebola River is in Democratic Republic of the Congo, at least 1,000 miles away. How does Ebola get from Central Africa to the West Coast? Unless it came from a laboratory, which Dr. Boyle persuasively argues. And so, I mean, we have these pandemics and these great diseases, but if we take the human factor out, we probably wouldn't have them. I mean, we are creating a self-fulfilling prophecy here.
Okay, what about what's going on in the United States? Have you got anything to say about that? The attempt by the Trump side to kind of keep going, and in a way, I mean, we've just had this week an attempt anyway of Trump supporters to actually storm the Congress to stop the attempt to ratify Joe Biden as president.
Yes, this has almost become a comic opera. I think there are two issues at stake here. One is that Donald Trump has no real allies anywhere, and that both parties want to get rid of him as quickly as possible. I mean, at one time we had the Republican Party, now we have the Trump-Publican Party. And the Trump-Publicans and the Republicans do not get along. I mean, I have no respect whatever for Mitch McConnell. I mean, he's one of the worst offenders, worst members of the Congress, I can imagine. But he himself is realizing that there is a limit to which anybody can support Donald Trump, and he's prepared to let Joe Biden take over the presidency. There is a split between the radical, I would probably say a little bit the pejorative way, the knuckle-dragging, sort of uneducated, knee-jerk, right-wing zealots who see Donald Trump as a sort of savior or some, like, I don't know, some quasi cult leader, that they want him back, they want him to stay in power. And those who were at least possessed of a basic political sensitivity. I mean, I think there is quite possibly a case to be made that some of the election results in some states weren't exactly accurate. I don't know enough to say, because what we get from the press is very one-sided. But I think what happened to Trump is that he lost the benefit of the doubt. I mean, Trump has committed so many acts of outrageous stupidity that he is a national and international embarrassment, that there is, I think, no willingness even to want to count to entertain the notion that there was something wrong with the election. I think people want to get rid of him as quickly as possible, put Biden in, because Biden's essentially a domesticated house pet too. He'll do whatever Israel tells him. He's an emasculated sock puppet, like everybody in the Democratic Party, which is Israel's natural governing party in the United States. And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who is a horrible choice for vice president, will be Israel's governors on the Potomac for the next 4 years. And so it doesn't matter which party wins. Israel is always the person who chooses the government, to all intents and purposes. And so it's not in anybody's interest to keep this loose cannon from firing off in the White House any longer than necessary. Again, Trump might have a case, but nobody really cares enough to want to do anything about it. And Trump has shot himself in the foot so many times, he can't walk a straight line.
So do you think there will be any real big changes in foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, with Biden?
No. I think Biden may be slightly more willing to adhere to some measure of diplomacy and rational governance. But there's going to be no hope in hell that Israel is going to have to worry about disobedience from its loyal satrap on the Potomac. There's going to be a little change. And as I stated in my first book, The Host and the Parasite, the United States, to borrow Pat Buchanan's famous phrase and paraphrase it slightly, is Israeli-occupied territory. And it has been since 1948. So no, America.
Okay. What about Hong Kong? Because there's been some very big developments there this week. 50 of their MPs, Congress people, their legislators who were elected have been arrested in dawn raids, they're also the proprietor of what the main newspapers in Hong Kong. It does seem as if the Chinese Communist Party using the pandemic, particularly as an opportunity to completely erase any possibility of the protest movements resurfacing.
Yes, it's not surprising. And again, this is the typical behavior of a tyrannical government. I mean, Hong Kong is in serious trouble. I mean, this is an area of the world that had a free Western society for over about 100 years. And now it's under the thumb of a despotic neo-feudal entity, and it's disturbing. I don't know what Hong Kong can do. I mean, China is such a huge country. I mean, you would have to have China fracture within before the Hong Kongese, can have any sort of relief from this. Again, the one thing China has to worry about is world opinion. But given the fact that China is so big, it can tell the world to go to hell, it doesn't really have to worry too much. Because the world can't really afford to do without China right now.
Okay, coming along the end of this month is the World Economic Forum. A lot of people are saying it's quite audacious of them to come up with this, it's okay, the economic problems are all going to go away because we've come up with a great plan to reset the world's economy called the Great Reset. Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum's founder, is sort of cheerleading this. But the other person involved is Prince Charles. And, of course, you as a Canadian, you have the same royal family as we do here in the UK. I wonder what you make of this. The other interesting aspect of all this, of course, is that there's this partnership agreement now between the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, which some commentators, it'd be interesting to see what you make of this, are saying that this is more like a hostile takeover of the UN because of the UN being strapped for cash. Global economics being as they are, governments around the world haven't been contributing their fair share to the UN, and the UN has actually held out its hand now to the World Economic Forum, who seem to be awash with money, and said, well, okay, we need a partnership here. So anyway, what do you make of the Great Reset and this month's World Economic Forum?
Well, the term Great Reset I've heard in context with a willful, planned, premeditated attempt to spread the virus in order to ground the world's economies so that they could be reset in such a way to favor the most powerful corporate entities in the world. So the way I understand it is that it was the plan all along, and this is what a lot of people think is the story behind SARS-CoV-2. It was designed to destroy world economies so that the plutocrats could grab ever more power for themselves. Now, Klaus Schwab, I know only tangentially. I do plan to look at him more closely because apparently he is one of the people who is sort of trying to stage manage the world's economies. I I don't really want to trust Schwab. To me, anybody of his power is something that should cause people concern. I do, however, not like the United Nations. I think the United Nations should be disbanded. The United Nations was a failure from the start as far as an entity to promote world security. As far as economics goes, it's always been strapped for cash, and the United States is the biggest delinquent of the entire membership because it will not fund the United Nations properly because it doesn't think, the United States doesn't think it has to adhere to any authority beyond itself. It's the American exceptionalist mentality that has rendered the United Nations somewhat suspect as an effective organization. So when the World Economic Conference comes calling and says, "Hi, United Nations, we'll give you a ton of money if you be our partner," and I kind of think the United Nations is sold out. So yes, it's sold out to the World Economic Forum, and so we're going to have the UN becoming, I would suggest, an enforcement arm of the World Economic Forum, the way it became an enforcement arm of NATO in the United States in the 1990s during the illegal overflights, no-fly zones, I mean, over Iraq. I mean, the United Nations has been an impotent debating chamber for the entire 70-odd years that Israel has been persecuting Palestinians. Rarely has the United Nations spoken up in defense of Palestine. And even when it does, it doesn't have any effect. I mean, the United Nations membership recognizes Palestine, but it hasn't got a seat in the General Assembly. I mean, you can't have, in sort of Eisenberg's exclusionary principle, you can't have two things occupying the same space. And so either Israel has to go or Palestine does, and I can prove that Israel is not legitimate as a state and is not even a bona fide member of the United Nations. So quite frankly,
how can you prove that? Would you just like to flesh that out a bit? How do you know? What do you mean by that?
Well, the United Nations admitted Israel as a member in 1949, I believe. I got to check the year. It was the only country ever admitted conditionally. It was admitted provided that it returned to Palestinians all monies and property stolen and allow Palestinians to live peacefully in their own land. Essentially, Israel had to promise to be a law-abiding state. And of course, it hasn't. It has violated the terms of admission. And because of that, it is not a member in good standing of the United Nations. Because it has not lived up to its terms of admission, it can be expelled physically overnight. There does not need to be a resolution of the General Assembly or the Security Council because this is a membership issue. It does not concern the Security Council. So Israel is an illegitimate country since it had no right to steal Palestine from the Palestinians, and leaving aside all the nonsense about the Holocaust, I mean, as H.G. Wells said, the UN had no authority to take land from one party and give it to another. It's just not possible.
When would you suggest that stealing of the land took place? Was it mainly the Six-Day War?
Oh, no, long before that. No, actually, land had been stolen going back to the beginning of the 20th century with the Aliyah, the movement of European Jews to Palestine. But it happened in earnest in a major way in November 29th, 1947, which is the year that the moment that Israel invaded Palestine under Plan Dalit to dispossess the Palestinians. And because of that, almost 800,000 Palestinians were removed from their land by invading Jews. And what's even more interesting about this, that Walter Eitan, who was a member of the Zionist Agency at the time, said the figure was closer to 800,000, but the official history books say it's about 700,000. Israel had no legitimacy. Harry Truman, President of the United States in March of 1948, was prepared to rescind U.S. support for the partition plan, which began November 29, 1947, which arbitrarily divided Palestine into Arab and non-Arab sectors, because he knew that it could not be carried out without severe injustices done to the Palestinians. Harry Truman did not want to go down in history as being a party to a war crime. So he was threatening to withdraw American support, because he knew what was happening. And in fact, if you go back to history, the British mandate of Palestine had not expired by the time David Ben-Gurion declared statehood.
So, can you just remind us of your titles of your book, finally, Greg? That is, you also maybe just like to plug your book on Israel-Palestine as well there.
Sure. My book is called The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America. It looks at the history of the United States from a different perspective. It looks at it through the seven stages of Zionism. The seven stages of the Zionization of America. It's a bit like the seven stages of man. And
take us through those briefly?
Well, yes. Each one is associated with a president. Truman, Johnson, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and I put Bush and Obama together because there's really not much difference, because essentially Obama continued Bush's criminality, and we end up with Donald Trump, who represents the apotheosis of the Zionization of America, the epitome of the Zionization of America. So each president somehow increases the indentured nature of America to Israel, because it was in 1948 that Harry Truman took his famous bribe to support the partition of Palestine into Jewish and non-Jewish sectors.
What bribe?
He took a bribe. It was on a whistle-stop tour of his that a member of the Jewish agency came up and gave him a suitcase full of $2 million. Because at the time, his great opponent was Thomas Dewey, governor of New York, and he had locked up the Lubavitcher Jewish vote in his back pocket, because nobody can expect to get elected without the big Jewish New York vote. So the Lubavitchers were going to go to Dewey. But at the last minute, Truman saw the writing on the wall and decided that he had better capitulate to the Jewish lobby to support Palestine, to support Israel. And he's famously quoted as saying, when asked why he did it, "I have 100,000 Jews in my constituency. I do not have 100,000 Arabs." Or it could have been Palestinians. Essentially, Truman admitted he took a bribe.
Okay, and what's the title of your book on COVID?
It's called SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption.
And whereabouts can listeners get hold of those, Greg?
Okay, for the SARS book, they should go to turningthetidepublishing.com. And for The Host and the Parasite, as well as Exploding Middle East Myths, they should go to moneytreepublishing.com. All three books are also available on Kindle.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.